You're listening to the podcast with a K, available on iTunes, Stitcher.com, Audio Boom, and thepodcast.co.uk. And if you're listening, I'm so sorry. Or, you know, leave a review or something. Thanks.
Welcome to the podcast with a K.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a podcast with a K. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you all. James McLean and Brian Turnover join me as ever. We are co-hosts now. I'm not the boss anymore. We're all the boss.
But you do all the work.
But yeah, apparently I do all the work.
Yeah, I thought we were all boss. Just, you know.
BSS.
Yeah.
I'm sure we were in 1992.
In that case, I can expect to see John Perry dressed as a cleaning lady at any point then.
Well, I thought that was the butler. That's not the butler?
Who knows? So you join us, dear listener, a few days after having listened to our Star Wars podcast, hopefully. Hey, guys, the Star Wars podcast is proving more popular than our last week Doctor Who podcast.
Go on.
No, really.
Then the Doctor Who one?
Yeah.
Okay, see, that surprises me a little bit. I was expecting a different one, but hey, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Let's just assume Star Wars might be something popular.
I've never heard of it. I don't know what you're talking about.
It's weird, man.
So anyway, that happened. Although, and you know, it was kind of strange because we called it Our Changing Viewing Habits Cutting Doctor Who UK Audience Figures, which is maybe a bit of a mouthful in hindsight.
So are you saying our audience figures carry some relativity to general interest within the show?
No, I just think I could have made a slightly punchier title for it.
Oh, I see. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Now, we were obviously going to talk about The Husbands of River Song, the 2015 Christmas Doctor Who episode, which aired on Christmas evening at 5:15, I think it was, which was nice and early.
Or we could do and actually reciprocate the resonation in TV audiences across the UK on that Friday and talk about Stickman, because that was obviously more popular.
What's that?
Stickman.
What's that?
It was about Stickman.
Who? What are you talking about?
Stickman. Did you not watch Stickman?
I don't even know what Stickman is.
Stickman is an adaptation of a book which starred Martin Freeman as the voice of Stickman and aired just before Doctor Who did, and actually got better viewing figures.
Right. Okay. I'm going to have to do some catching up here, which we don't have time
I think
for
you will.
Today's podcast.
Absolutely. Everyone here is going, well, you don't know about Stickman. We came here to talk about, so we wanted to listen about Stickman. It was really popular. We enjoyed it on Saturday.
Right.
After we'd watched
Stickman.
He's not in the. He's in the States, isn't he? He's got an excuse.
I just want to know how far out of things I am. Brian, have you heard of Stickman?
Totally. Yes. I watched that on Christmas Day.
Okay, so you did.
Stickman. No. It's about a stick which gets lost.
Is it also a man?
It's a stick that is also a bit of a man as well.
Right.
It goes away. It leaves its stick family. Goes for a wander in the woods. You can see why this was more interesting than The Husbands of River Song.
I'm failing at the moment, and that's saying something, but do carry on.
And the various things come to take the stick man, thinking it is just a stick. And slowly but surely, it gets further removed from its home dwelling of its stick tree, which is kind of weird if you think about it. I mean, a stick man living in a stick tree is like me living in a large carcass of a human. But
yeah,
there
slightly,
you go.
Slightly.
Possibly even the carcass of your mother, depending on how far the stick had fallen from the branches. But anyway, yeah, so Stickman was that. My point being is that Stickman was directly before Doctor Who. It was 25, 30 minutes or so before Doctor Who aired.
Right,
and there was a viewing figure drop off on the overnights between Stickman and Doctor Who, which, you know, given that they're both for sort of family audiences and for kids.
Was Stickman on BBC?
It was. It was BBC One directly before Doctor Who.
Right, okay. I'm interested at the way that you introduced a kind of Hieronymus Bosch vision.
Yes, the triptych of heaven and hell thing.
Yeah, and the, yeah, yeah, that thing, yeah.
Yeah.
With your carcass living within type thing. Yeah, that's all very, very... Was that in Stickman as well?
No, it wasn't. Everything apart from Stickman was fairly mundane in the sense it was dogs, cats, kids.
Right.
Father Christmas, maybe.
Okay. Brian, sorry, you're going to say something.
I was going to say, I actually would have rather watched Stickman. So I'm kind of sad we didn't get it over here now.
Oh, there we go. That was nice.
Clearly, I'm going to have to look it up and catch up there. I mean, there's a lot of things I need to catch up with over this Christmas. I was watching a very interesting program, which must have been a repeat with...
Wasn't Doctor Who then, right?
No, I'm not sure if it was Victoria Corrin or Victoria Corrin Mitchell, because which one it would have been would have kind of dated when it came out, perhaps, about P.L. Travers and Disney and Mary Poppins. And it's basically a documentary version of the film Saving Mr. Banks. Which was really interesting yesterday afternoon, and then Mary Poppins was on straight after it. But on a different channel. Which is why it made me wonder whether Stickman was on ITV or BBC Two or whatever. So the Husbands of River Song was, thanks. Oh, what's this?
That's Viewing Figures.
Viewing Figures, thanks for that. So the Husbands of River Song aired on Christmas night, as Doctor Who Christmas specials are wont to do. Doctor Who hit home with overnight ratings of 5.8 million, thanks to James there. And Doctor
James,
Who
you watched that many times?
Yes. I did, inadvertently.
That is a 29.4 share, 29.4% share of the audience. Stickman, which, as we say, slightly earlier, 6.4 million, 34.5% of the audience.
Now, you see, I think this is something I've noticed, because certain Doctor Who websites that won't be named, except for when Christian at the end of the podcast accidentally says them, as he always does, have suggested there was a very nice editorial by Philip Bates about this whole, about not to be too concerned about the drop-off on Doctor Who this year. But I do think a lot of sites, and perhaps including Philip, if I may be so bold, missed that there is quite a big correlation, I think, between the channel, the type of show, and the audience percentage and the actual viewing figures between Stickman and Doctor Who. I think they're two very relevant ones to look at because of their close proximity, because of their audience demographic, and because there is quite a disparity.
I think we should come clear and say the actual reason that we left Casterbus was because of the fact that we all completely disagreed with what Casterbus was saying audience figures.
It seems like each week I'm picking a fight with someone who actually works still at Casterbus. And maybe I am. Maybe Richard needed a time off. I haven't seen Richard speak since the last podcast, so I might have left him crying. But I think Stickman is a very interesting one, because while I think Philip's right in the sense that you can't sort of look at these figures and say, well, that's it for Doctor Who, it's only got 5.8 million instead of 13 million or whatever it was getting in its heyday at Christmas. There has been an audience drop-off at Christmas, as he suggests in the article, which is very true. But I do think if you were to honestly be looking and sort of saying, what are the issues with Doctor Who, I think the fact that you had something for children right before Doctor Who, which was obviously meant to lead into Doctor Who, and then you see a drop off of, you know, almost not well about sort of over 500,000 viewers, and the audience share changing quite dramatically. It's interesting enough, if you actually look at it, the audience share Stickman had the highest. So I suppose, Brave.
It'd be interesting to know what the audience share breakdown was.
I mean, I suppose you could argue that if Stickman had a higher audience share of 34.5, Doctor Who had 29.4. You might argue that, I don't know. I mean, this is a thing with statistics. You can throw it either way, can't you? You can band it around. Does that mean that Doctor Who can't be overly compared because the audience share was different? If the audience share was the same, and there was
depends
a drop. No, that's the other
depends
way around.
Isn't it? I mean, they're obviously in different slots. Were they both post Queen? If they were both post Queen's speech, then
Stickman was 16:45.
Right. Okay.
45 for America.
Right, so it's on for an hour. So we're talking about like that whole sort of evening kind of come down.
Half an hour.
Big bang.
5:15.
Right, yeah. Big bang. Yeah. But either way, what I'm saying is, it's that post Queen's speech come down. I mean, I say post Queen's speech come down. I mean, I was eating my dinner at the time the Queen's speech was on. I don't watch the Queen's speech. I couldn't give a monkey's what the Tax Sponge has got to say about anything, quite frankly.
But then,
that's just my opinion and not the opinion of James or Brian.
But then this is the other thing that comes in, which is very interesting when you look at the viewing day figures. Straight after Doctor Who, audience share goes back up to 30.3% and 6.5 million as the overall for Strictly Come Dancing.
Yeah.
Which isn't actually very good for Strictly, to be fair. I mean, this is what Philip was saying. You know, the audience figures weren't brilliant for anything, really.
Is it then... This is what I was talking about, audience breakdown. Is it the case then that perhaps Doctor Who's audience has dropped off a bit more than we actually think it is in terms of, you know, the mainstream audience, and actually it's been bumped up by millennial fangirls?
I don't know. I just think it's kind of interesting that Doctor Who... I don't know. You'd have kind of hoped. I kind of would have hoped it to have been higher, really.
Mm, yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Listen. Has, and I want to thank Brian Turnover for this, is the casting of Matt Lucas and Greg Davies the modern day equivalent of Helen Pace? And oh, thank you. You beat me to it.
I knew you were going to say.
And is Moff Nathan Turner outstaying his welcome even further?
Yes. I have to tell you, okay, I recognized the bald guy. I don't know his name, so I'm sorry, but I recognized
Matt
him.
Yeah, Matt Lucas.
Okay. I recognized him from something with Steve Williams. Is that his name? David Williams.
Little Britain?
Yes, that. Sure. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And the second I saw him, I just thought, oh, God, because I knew where it was going. You weren't going to get a serious performance out of him. And I shouldn't say that. That's kind of rude because, I mean, even a comedy performance is serious. But what I meant is a dramatic performance. Let's say it that way. It was just going to be Stephen Moffat's comic relief. And this, again, was just another episode where every character was comic relief rather than having any kind of tension or danger or drama to it. I just didn't feel anything of that. And it was, again, it was just like a waste of space. Like, I know it's supposed to be fun and light because it's Christmas, but man, it was not fun and light. It was just, I don't know, comedy without comedy, it seems, you know?
Brian, talking to the thing upon your neck here, did you find it better or
Brian
worse?
Face?
His Brian face, thank you. I couldn't remember what it was called. Was this worse than you expected? Because you had very low expectations. Was it better than you expected compared to what you expected?
It was probably about what I expected. It's got River Song in it, which obviously, as you guys know, I wasn't really expecting much with. However, I was hoping that Capaldi's interactions with her would be very different from Smith's, and thankfully they were. And I actually did enjoy. What I enjoyed was the fact that she knew what all the doctor's faces looked like, and she couldn't comprehend the fact that the doctor could have something past 13. And I thought that was great. And I liked the fact that they played with the whole, you know, it's one of those things where, like, he should have just come out and said, I'm the doctor, rather than waiting for her to guess it. But it worked for me that he was, like, waiting for her to guess it. Like, come on, put this together. You're smarter than that. So I enjoyed that. Probably 90% of the story I did not enjoy. The second he comes walking out of the TARDIS and he mentions something about a new suit and a haircut somewhere along the line, or he says it to River. I don't remember where. It was just like, okay, so this definitely is the story where he's giving her the sonic screwdriver right before she goes and dies.
That was a relief. Know?
Yeah, well, it was.
That was an early on relief.
It was until you get to the end, and then we get the end of series 9 all over again. Clara doesn't have to go back to dying immediately.
Yeah.
At least she can get her own TARDIS and fly off for the next 90 years before she goes and dies. And now Riversong, well, she gets 25 years of who knows what the hell her and Capaldi are going to do. I don't want to think about that, quite frankly. But no, she's not going to go straight to the library and die, because why should any character go have some sort of a sad life in this show, you know, the way that it's predicted? Why can't it all be happy and cheerful? You know, it was a terrible ending. The text at the end was a terrible ending.
On the other hand, we did get to see the kind of dark side, bad side to River Song. Now, the Doctor got to see it as well.
What, her polygamy sort of thing?
Yeah, well, like the polygamy, her sort of like immoral behaviour, which is clearly something which perhaps weren't that familiar with other than her first appearance. So, and the Doctor gets to see that. So that's.
But it was joked upon. It never really. And her comeback that, well, you've been with Elizabeth, Marilyn Monroe, were all before he was married to her. So,
yeah.
And so it was all just washed aside as a bit of a joke. So any tension or any relevance or any depth to what that was trying to do was just ended up being a sort of about as complex and as engaging and as classy as Heidi High, because
you know
that really is where it went.
Yeah, I did enjoy the fact that like her perspective of the Doctor was that he never really loved her, you know. Yeah, she loved him, but he never really loved her. I thought that was good. But then you get, you know, his reactions and the end of the show where it kind of showed like either he can't say it, like he couldn't with Rose, and but he does love her, or he just, you're right, I don't know. I liked the perspective because it's what I said all along, that the Doctor was never in love with River Song. He just knew what she believed their life was, and she was the daughter of his best friend. So he tried to give her the life that she believed she had. I never believed there was real love there. And I swear that you can see that in Matt Smith's era because of how uncomfortable he is with all the sexual stuff between the two of them. I mean, he's, you know, he's like a fish out of water with it, and it's ridiculous. You know, and you can see it in Matt Smith's performance. He's extremely uncomfortable with it. And I liked that, and I liked how they played it there. But then you get the very end of the episode, and it's like, why did you just take that away again? You know, like it was great. It was true. And I think he did it probably because, you know, Moffat reads fan sites, you know, and he's admitted that. And I think he sees what fans are saying. So he wanted to throw in their faces yet again. This is exactly what I say it is. And here you go. Now there's no question about it. And it's like, I hate that. You know, it's just like, leave some. The things that he leaves open-ended are the things that you certainly should give us closure on. Like, I don't know, plot points to a story that you're telling. And the things that he decides to actually give finality on are the things that probably should have been left open-ended. Like something like this, where we could draw our own conclusions on it. But he seems to have it backwards, and he seems to want to rub it in our faces. And it just doesn't work.
I think it's sad that, you know, back in Series 1, the empty child, sorry, the Doctor dances, sort of was an unusual one in the fact that he defied the sort of standard trope of Doctor Who by having everybody lives and sort of say, hey, every Doctor Who is pretty downbeat because everyone is in pain or dying or there's some sadness, but not this case. Everybody lives. And that was unusual.
Yeah.
And now it's like it's the inverse, that he can't let something play to what Doctor Who should be. I was listening to, just to clarify to anyone out listening out there, I was not watching, because I don't have it. Mm. I was listening to The Massacre.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, I do. All this time, eh? All sitting. Every time I'm on this podcast, I'm there rubbing those cans of film across my naked body. Fans unaware of this tawdry, horrible sexual power that I'm getting for holding all the missing episodes. I was listening to The Massacre. And at the very end, there is actually a really lovely little piece with Hartnell where he sort of says how everyone leaves him, how they don't understand how time works, because Stephen's just stormed out as well. And it's a very, even in those very early years, there is that sort of slight hint that there is a sort of melancholy to the character, that he is perpetual and everyone will go. And so even then you had that. And then just recently, in the last few years of Moffat, he seems to have got into this thing where he won't have that. And when someone dies like Clara, that's totally, I mean, Clara has a better time now than ever. I mean, God, I think we'd all wish we'd have the Raven. Because, I mean, I thought at one point, well, maybe there's a risk that if she dies before she gets back by some accident, the world could end. But I think the whole point is she can't die at all, because she's like Barrowman, like Captain Jack, suspended.
Oh, no, probably not like Jack, actually. Probably more like Owen Harper.
Yes.
Perhaps. Because Jack isn't suspended, is he? He heals. Right.
Yeah,
but this is a Torchwood reference for those.
But she's a sort of a fixed point of time, essentially.
Oh, there's that, I suppose, as well.
So she has a best time because now she can just travel, because she's got a time machine, she can just live her life and a thousand other lives before she has to go back and decide to die. She can go whenever she likes. So she has a better life now than she had before she died. And then here we have this really unrealistic ending, which does not work for me in either character, because they have to stay on that planet technically. If you're going to live to the essence of the gesture that he's giving her, which is one last night, and that last night is 24 years, they've surely got to stay on that planet then. So that's 24 years they've got to spend on that planet together. And okay,
not necessarily. They might have arrived there before the night.
Well, even worse then, isn't it? So two nights, it's like 50 years.
No, I mean, before, after the night had started, I beg your pardon.
Well, you could argue that, but the essence, I mean, you could also argue that they won't stay all that time, but the essence of the narrative, the suggestion that the writer's giving to you is that they have 24 years to spend together before she has to go.
Well, shall we just cut to the chase? Because clearly the only thing that really happened in that line, single line of dialogue, which was at least mentioned a little earlier, was that Stephen Moffat thought, hello, I'm a clever writer. Let's make this a very long night.
Well, I think it's more than that. I think, in a sense, what he does, he puts on a ridiculous amount of time. He ages the character. I know, yeah, okay, this character is ageless, isn't he? But because he's fictional. But he uses years on the character in a way to almost cement his narrative as being, you know, important. If you sort of say, well, this character, I make this statement, and so he stays there for 24 years. You're saying to ephemeral characters like ourselves, this must be a really important, serious statement to make. You know, he was he spent 1,000 years on Trenzalore, which is an insultingly amount of time. That's longer than the Doctor Who had actually, the character lived for, that we'd seen. And in one flippant gesture, that same amount of time is spent in a place that the writer's devised. It seems to be somehow linked to sort of trying to cement events as being really important. But if he had sort of said, well, we'll be spending the week here together, that wouldn't be enough, because that wouldn't really show how much he cares for her. 24 years of his life he'll stay there for her, is what it's suggesting. Mm. Which is totally against everything. I mean, he could barely stay in unit. He had to, you know, he was unhappy he was there for a week. Now, you could say he's mellowed after Trenzalore, but that seems to go against the character. It goes against her character as well. She gets bored. She gets itchy feet.
She wants to get up to mischief.
Exactly. So unless they're doing loads and loads of adventures on the planet, which again sort of goes against the sort of idea of the line, which is like a 24-year romance, is what it's sort of suggesting. 24 years of being together. It just doesn't sit. I don't think people can sort of really imagine that.
What was that Series 6 episode, the long invasion, the slow invasion, whatever it was, the one with the black cubes? I can't remember
Power 3.
The name of the Power 3.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Whatever. Where he couldn't even spend, you know, 2 hours doing nothing but waiting for this invasion without going insane, watching time pass slowly. I think that even happened to him in the Van Gogh episode. He had issues with watching time pass slowly. You know, it kills me that for some reason, I can't tell if Moffat just wants his doctors to be the longest running in their own particular eras due to the doctor's age by how long that actual version of the doctor was in that particular body, or if he just wants to make these things seem grand and romantic and just makes them actually seem far less grand and romantic than they actually are. You know, it would have been more powerful to me had they quite literally had just the one night before she had to go die, rather than this whole 25 years where it's just kind of like, well, what the hell is that? What's the point of that? You know, like there's no point to it now whatsoever. All that means is that this is where you gave her the sonic screwdriver before you actually said goodbye to her, and she went off to do a million things before going to the library. You know, now it has no significance. Same thing with Clara's death. It has no significance. It has no weight, because the sacrifice that she made to save the doctor because of her death was no sacrifice. If you can go off and live your own freaking life. And it's the same thing here. And it's what made it so pointless. You get to the end of this story hoping that there was something to justify it, and there's not.
Did the events at the close of the story, at least, did they come maybe 2 or 3 years too late?
Well, this is the other problem with the episode. I think if we're looking at statistics, I was watching this and I was thinking, who is this really appealing to? This is the point. I mean, fandoms fandom is split on River Song. I mean, there's a lot of people who do genuinely think she's brilliant, and that's fine, and I'm pleased for them. But there's a lot, like myself, who really dislike her. So you can't even say it's like Davros and the Daleks, where most fans are behind Davros and the Daleks as an interesting thing. So it splits fandom. I'm not convinced that kids are very interested in the will they and won't they of two older people.
Of course they're not.
I don't think teenagers are either, because teenagers are inherently self-centered in so far as their own age groups. You know, that's why teen shows always have young people in them, because they empathize with you empathize with people your own age, tendency is. So it doesn't appeal to them. River Song is a story that lasted, it was 2 years ago. The Sonic Screwdriver 2008,
2 years ago,
well, wasn't she? That was the last when name of the Doctor, wasn't it? Just before the Day of the Doctor was when she. So that was 2012, wasn't it? No, 2013.
2.5 years ago.
So 2.5 years ago.
Yeah, more.
So
than that,
she but... is 2.5 years ago. The Sonic Screwdriver thing is 2008. So very few people remember that, and that's like a very important point at the end of the story. So who the hell is it being written for? It feels like it doesn't touch anyone enough to that they're going to sort of want to turn over when Stickman finishes. You know.
Like, yeah. Okay, so just pretend you're not a Doctor Who fan for a minute, dear listener. And Stickman's just finished, and now comes next on BBC One, the Doctor is reunited with River Song in the 2015 Christmas special, The Husbands of River Song, or something along those lines. Does that make you want to stay and watch Doctor Who? Does it discover that the Doctor's going to bump into River Song again?
Well, the title isn't interesting as well.
Well, yeah, exactly.
The title is utterly focused on River Song, so it seems to presume that people will come to watch it, because that's what titles are there for. They're paratext to sort of get you to watch, to get you into what the product.
Our changing viewing habits, cutting Doctor Who UK audience figures. You're absolutely right, James.
Well, this is it. I'm not quite sure what happened there.
Well, what it was is we're talking about the importance of titles, and it obviously recalls the conversation we had earlier.
Yes, of course,
when I asked up the last podcast, last Doctor Who podcast title.
Totally right. Yeah, absolutely. And that is very important, that titles do make or break. They can do. And it's an extremely self-focused title. You know, you've got to really love River Song to find that title.
This is self-absorption, isn't it? Doctor Who disappearing up its own arse.
Yeah, I don't like sort of going down that sort of high.
No, I don't either. But I mean, we have been skirting around the edges of this for some months at least two series, and the vast amount of past continuity, particularly in series 9, is. I think we were talking about this at the beginning of series 9 as well, weren't we? The number of references to former Doctors and former stuff. The clips of David Tennant and the clip of Tennant, what was that in? That was in the Fires of Pompeii. That was in the episode whose name escapes me at the moment. But earlier in the series, we had the clip from Genesis of the Daleks as well, which obviously is 40 years old. And it's in many ways, this is just like echoing, but to a greater degree, what Nathan Turner and Soward were doing in the 80s, relying on former Doctor Who episodes.
But this is what
inform their current stories.
This is what I said the other week, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When I was saying about Garrick, the difference between the Graham Williams and John Nathan Turner in terms of viewing figures and wide demographics was very similar to what we're having now. And John Nathan Turner's, even the very beginning, was far more focused on science fiction and fans than Douglas Adams and Graham Williams were doing with the season before it.
Mm.
So you can see even there that there is that disparity seems to be mirror what's going on now. But this episode, I mean, this is something that Brian was saying the other week, wasn't it? How Stephen Moffat was sort of saying that he thought this was his last one, so he was bringing it back. So in a sense, he was even admitting that this was a bit of an indulgence on his part, that he wanted to.
Well, that makes a change, doesn't it?
What did you feel about? Because Brian, you said the other week that you were about the extra clip, the mini episode where Matt Smith and River talk about how did you feel now seeing this, your fear realized.
Okay, well, in fairness, the one thing I will say to Moffat is that he seemed to have remembered that he had written that clip, because in this Christmas special, they made mention that every time they were going to go to the Singing Towers of Dúrlim, or whichever the name, however you pronounce that, is they changed their mind and went somewhere else, or something else happened to stop them from going there. So that moment there in that little DVD clip or Blu-ray clip, you know, it's kind of made okay, because it's like he thinks he's going there but changes his mind. Like, he couldn't bring himself to do it. So I'm kind of okay with the idea of that. However, I will still say, and I think I said this in one of the other podcasts that we just did recently, the other Doctor Who podcast, was I agree with Matt Smith. River should have stayed tied up with the 10th and the 11th Doctor. Like, there's been no proof that she's met any previous Doctors, because if she had, Tennant would have known her when he saw her in the library. And she certainly shouldn't have needed to see any future ones, because she was tied up with 11. That was technically her Doctor. And what I thought should have happened, and should have probably happened in time of the Doctor, Matt should have gone back to say goodbye to her, kind of in a similar way that Tennant did, and maybe it would have been a reused idea, but it would have been more interesting because the man did have a haircut, number one. You know, he shaved his head, and it was on screen, you know? Well, they gave him a bald cap for whatever reason. And he could have gone back with a new suit. We could have wrapped up this River Song storyline, and it would have been fine. And like I said, the actor asked out of respect for Stephen Moffat not to bring River back. It was his one thing. And it was, to me, it's just still a very disrespectful thing to your leading actor, whom you showed a lot of respect for, to just go ahead and bring this character back and do this kind of thing with them. And I don't know. And maybe that's just because I don't like her and I didn't want to see her return. But I also do think, you know, I agree with Matt. I think Matt had very good points about why she shouldn't come back. And seeing it here, knowing that clip that was on the Blu-ray scene, I guess it's better that it's in an actual episode because the casual audience will understand the end of her story if anybody's actually following her story to that degree as a casual viewer.
Well, that's it. It is a very indulgent end to the story that no one really needed. We never saw the beginning of their relationship, so why we needed to see the penultimate seemed a bit, indulgent.
Well, you know what? Let me tell you the best thing about it. As a Doctor Who prop collector, you guys know I have all the sonic screwdrivers that the Doctor has used, you know, aside from now the newest one that he's got. Well, I am glad to see that in an episode, the Doctor actually hands her the, quote, future Sonic, which is what it has become known as, because we know now for sure that he specifically made it just for her. He never used it. You know, and that's all I need to know. If I will get one for my collection, sure, because it's kind of a neat-looking sonic screwdriver, but I am glad to see that there's no Doctor actually associated with it, because I don't want to have a war doctor of Sonics. You know, I don't want to have a Paul McGann of Sonics. I don't want to have a history that we never get to see within the show. So now we know for sure he made it specifically to give to her, basically to let her die and then live again in a computer because, hey, God, that's romantic.
Did you find the hilarity of the Sonic trowel worked?
No,
it was about as awesome as the Sonic sunglasses.
Are much better than a Sonic trowel. The Sonic trowel is just stupid.
Yeah,
even a Sonic lipstick works, but Sonic trowel, come on.
Yeah, no, it was okay. The Sonic sunglasses were Stephen Moffat trying to go ahead and get his own psychic paper for his era, trying to get his own Sonic screwdriver. He realized that way back in the 60s, the show had created a sonic device out of a screwdriver that had lived on in infamy. Then he realized, oh crap, Russell T. Davis did the same damn thing with a piece of paper. It's so good, I'm still using it in my era. I need something as clever as that. And so he goes ahead and he renames a pair of sunglasses, which don't even have anything special done to them like the sonic screwdriver did, even though in Troughton's era, let's be honest, it was a pen light. Guess what? It wasn't a screwdriver. They used a different device. So if you really wanted Sonic sunglasses, do something different to them. But instead, he tries to cash in on that, and he comes up with something extremely lame. And, you know, what he should have done was turn those sunglasses into a completely different device, something interesting, like he did in The Girl Who Waited, when the sunglasses were an actual window to see what somebody else was seeing. Guess what? You could have resurrected those damn things and made them do something more. But no, you made Sonic sunglasses because the Doctor got so upset at this whole Davros situation that he left the Sonic screwdriver behind and couldn't bear to make another one. So he went ahead and made something less Doctorish and made himself cool with some sunglasses. That's something that should have belonged in the Matt Smith era, by the way, so he could have said how cool he was with such a lame idea. And then now they go ahead and they make the Sonic trowel because, you know, God, people just can't shovel things anymore, can they? There's just nothing you can do in this world without making it Sonic, you know? And it's absolutely asinine. The thing that I absolutely hate about the new series is that the Sonic screwdriver was such a clever device that it lived on for so many years just because of how clever it was. And it was unique, and it was something that the Doctor had made up. It was one of those things that reminded you, this man is a scientist, and this man is nonviolent. He went ahead and he invented himself a Sonic screwdriver. He made this thing. You know, and then unfortunately you get the Moffat's era and the TARDIS is making them. They just churn them out anytime he freaking needs one rather than the Doctor actually making it. Tennant even says in series 3 when his Sonic gets destroyed that he made himself another one. He doesn't say the TARDIS made me another one. He made it. in Moffat's era, screw that. You know, the TARDIS is just kind of like, hey, man, you're losing these things like, I don't know, like a kid loses candy. Here you go. Go ahead. I'll just make them for you from now on.
Well,
hey,
I think maybe
what?
You're oversimplifying.
Here's some sonic sunglasses
stuff
for
there,
you.
Brian Taranova. Maybe I don't he's think built into the TARDIS a tool to which he can then modularly create a new sonic screwdriver when he needs one.
Christian, do you think Stephen Moffat is that intelligent?
No, I don't.
Hey, no,
listen,
I don't.
A sonic trowel, right? I would rather have a sonic suitcase as invented by Lance Parkin, I think it was, in Father Time, when the Doctor, the Eighth Doctor, after losing his memory, doesn't know who he is, really. He hasn't got a TARDIS that works or anything like that. He's been stuck on Earth for nearly 100 years. Builds a sonic suitcase using available technology, because obviously there's no miniaturization that'll work on a sonic screwdriver level. That's a good idea. Sonic sunglasses, yeah, not such a good idea. Sonic trowel, just stupid.
I would rather have a sonic new showrunner.
I think we've broken him, Christian.
If anyone has broken Brian Taranova, it is Moff Nathan Turner.
I think the one thing I will go against, I dare go against Brian, furious. Gale that he is.
At least he's kept his potty mouth closed.
He certainly has.
I think
time.
We were nearing that.
He's trying. He's trying. He's getting better.
I didn't. I felt that the whole thing of River not recognizing the Doctor was not as a gag. It was too long. But I just again felt I just couldn't believe it. I know you found that okay, Brian. I could that really irritated me.
The only thing that saved it for me was the fact that River couldn't comprehend that he could live past 13. I think that's why I liked it.
I think what got me was the whole point originally was is that he did the whole point that was set up once they decided that Tennant wasn't doing another year and Moffat, by the looks of it, adopted the idea he had for River Song's return to Matt Smith, was that the idea was is that it wasn't the face that mattered. She could tell that he was the Doctor, which
right.
is why
yeah.
when he meets,
yeah.
she meets Tennant, she can't understand why he doesn't recognize her, because all she sees is the Doctor. And now suddenly, for the sake of a gag, even next to his TARDIS, this guy has called himself the Doctor. She's not even thinking, you know, as you would in the Doctor universe, is this an alternate version of the Doctor? Is this a trans-dimensional variant? So, you know, is it the Doctor's fucking son? You know, no, none of it. He's just this weird, eccentric guy who dresses very similar to several of the Doctors, who lurks around a TARDIS, who knows about time, works out time fields. I mean, you could do as Brian says, and you have to do it this way to make it work, is that she's so arrogant. So self-assured in herself that she just doesn't think that this could possibly be the Doctor. It's the only way you can actually make it work.
I didn't know you were doing a podcast in the toilet, Brian.
Hey?
I didn't realize you were doing your podcast from the toilet.
I was spilling some water, unfortunately.
Oh, sorry. It's just how it sounded.
We're calling it now.
Yeah,
I am just off to spill some water.
This is how I feel about the new Doctor Who episode. No, you know what, though? It does bring up an interesting question, though, and maybe, again, this is not something that I think Moffat is clever enough to bring up, but what if the new regeneration cycle that was given to the Doctor is partly to blame? What if River can't see the man
Could
for
be.
Who he was
yeah.
because this new cycle has altered him in some way, and this it really is a new life cycle, a new span for him? Now, here's the thing. This is one of the things I always loved about this show was the fan speculation aspect, where we would sit there and try and figure out things that they didn't explain in the show. Unfortunately, some of those things do kind of need to be explained. And I'm with you on your point. Like, I thought it was a silly gag. I did feel it went on too long, but I kind of enjoyed it a little bit. But you actually make a very valid point that, you know, she recognized him in the library. Now, granted, she also apparently in her little diary had all of his faces down, so she probably recognized him because she'd known what all of his faces looked like. So that's the other thing. She might not be able to tell who is or who isn't the Doctor. She just knows in this diary that she has a running history of what his faces are. And she even said at one point she didn't know what order. She just knew what his faces were. Capaldi's is clearly not in that book. So I guess that's one other out that we can use as well.
Okay.
It's amazing the things I remember from his era, only watching these episodes like once.
Yeah.
But it is frustrating for a gag. I think if they didn't have the police box there, they could have got away with it if she had not found the TARDIS.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm one of the few people who didn't find his rush around the TARDIS and having to pretend it was, you know, something new. I think one part annoyed me because this seems to be this sort of meta turning Doctor Who on its head seems to be something he just enjoys doing the whole time. It's how can I do something different, which is good, I suppose. You're meant to be doing that. You're meant to be looking at how can you challenge your material. But it seems to be such trivial ways, and I didn't find it funny either. I think that was the problem with this episode, is that he can, I mean, Curse of Fatal Death, while some of it is just very silly, he does do a very good job at doing humour beats. He can do good comedy writing, and some of his dialogue can be funny. But this felt so forced all the way through.
You know, and I keep thinking back too, for me, going back to the 50th, you know, there was great comedic moments between the three doctors in that story. And there was also great serious moments within that story. You know, that it worked. I was very surprised when I saw the 50th, enjoying it as much as I did, despite, you know, the fact that, I still had a few issues with it. But, you know, and then, of course, you go back to, can't think of which one it is. The one Capaldi just did alone this year. I never remember the name of that thing. Heaven Sent. But it was great. It was serious. It was done extremely well. And it still had a few little light comedic moments in it as well. You know, just little asides. And you do. I know his base was comedy. I don't need every episode of Doctor Who to be that comedic. It's what killed the girl who died. You know, that's what killed that story for me. As we talked about it, well, partially that. The fact that the woman who died. Yes. Partially that. It's his aspect that every character has to be comedic, and I can't stand that. I can't stand that at all. I don't mind if you've got one. It kind of works sometimes if you have a good one, but every character is comedic. Every character is an idiot. And, of course, what killed that story as well, too, was what we talked about before, was the use of technology saving the day after removing the Doctor from technology. But I don't know. It's just amazing how he can sometimes get it right and then most times get it completely wrong, and I don't know why. There's that disconnect in his head that he can't stay connected with what he had gotten right.
I think there was the other problem was that I got the impression that this was done comedic because the rest of this series had been so serious that you needed something light. That was almost the way it seemed to be pitched, that the Christmas episode would be very much a fun and a lightweight thing after such a dark, serious, which I suppose Heaven Sent was. But beyond that, Hellbent just totally undid it. Hellbent seemed as trivial as this episode. I found the fact that this episode, there was no real repercussions from the previous one. I suppose you could argue there wouldn't be because he'd have forgotten everything. But it did genuinely feel like a waste of watching. River Song was, to be fair, if I was going to give it any credit, I'd say River Song wasn't as annoying as she usually is. Possibly because she was unaware that she wasn't in control in this one. But the rest of it just felt like Heidi High with a big fan moment tacked on the end.
I agree. I did find River a little bit better. It was at least until the moment that she came to realize who the Doctor was. And then she put on her River face again. And then I lost
all that sensation. I've only just seen your head. It's like, yeah, God's sake. I mean, is this what men just think women should be like? That they just wish women were like? That women were just interested in phallic areas? Is that really the... I mean, I'm by no means a prude, but I just kind of feel it frustrates me when stuff's written like that the whole time. You know, if you want to write pornography like that, that's fine. That is what pornography is all about. But, you know, women... in stories like this who are cool and sexy, who really, you know, it's all about the sexuality thing. You know, do they sleep with women as well? You know, are they just interested in the person's manhood, really? You know, it's just, oh, just give it a rest. It's not cool. It's very, as I say, it's a cross between Heidi High and a child. And it's a shame because Heaven Sent was such a good episode on so many levels.
Yeah.
You know, you really see what he can do. Even if there were bits of it that I didn't particularly like, I can't, you know, watching it, the pacing, the ideas, the monologues were so very beautifully done. The dialogues within himself were so beautifully done with the Clara thing. It was really good stuff. And that's what I always remember him for. And I think one's got to be careful when we talk like this. You start to end up sort of becoming so to the point where you start constructing an image of someone like Mr. Moffat as incompetent, and he's not. He is a very skilled, intelligent writer. He's a very passionate Doctor Who fan. And it's a shame when you get stories like this, which just sort of, I don't know, smear his image in a weird way for some of us. Others loved it. I think it's worth pointing out. I mean, I saw a lot of people who enjoyed The Lightweight. Did you notice that? It wasn't like it was universally hated.
Yeah. Well, that's always the way it is with his era. You know, that's how it is with any era of Doctor Who. Some fans are going to like things more than other fans are going to like them. It's just always how it's been.
But I'm very keen, I think, because in this situation, and quite frequently of late, more so than through a lot of Moffat's era where we've been doing podcasts, we've all seemed to be in agreement about these episodes. And a lot of the time we're in agreement, not very much in the showrunner's favour. And I'm wary that people listening to this will start to think that we have some sort of hubris, that we think that what we say is what everyone else thinks or what is fact.
I think the problem is there's obviously many different ways of looking at it. And I think, obviously, I'm not going to argue with anything that you've just said, but I think there's possibly this question of decision making. And to some fans, he's made the right decisions. At other times, he's made the wrong decisions, and it's how you balance that out. And in the most recent Doctor Who magazine, he says you could play River as a slightly badass lady version of the Doctor, but Alex didn't go for that. Didn't she? Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. This how we interpret the different decisions that he makes at different times. And sometimes he makes absolutely all the right decisions, and other times he doesn't. And, you know, we need to go back to that old adage of no one sets out to make a bad episode.
No, absolutely. I think that is something important to... I'd like to distinguish us from other Doctor Who podcasts, which do feel like they have some sort of godly opinion. And I don't believe that any of us believe that. I think that is a fair point.
Well, you know, and the main, you know, and we've said it before, the main thing we did with the podcast is...
Nearly.
Yeah, yeah. is we give our true opinions, you know, and you know, we are honest. We talk about the things that we like, we talk about the things that we dislike, and we're not sitting here talking about the show as being the most amazing thing so that we can get some perks from the BBC, you know, because that's not giving our true opinions. That's BS. Right, you know, exactly. So hopefully our listeners have been around long enough to know what we like and what we don't like, and just know that, like, some things just don't strike our chords, you know, in the same way as maybe it does theirs, you know. And we can be honest. I mean, especially hopefully they heard with the whole Heaven Sent thing how much we all enjoyed that particular episode. But I don't know, when something is really good to me, I have no issue talking about how great it is. When something is not, you know, that's exactly what I got to talk about too. And if that is an issue for people, well, I'm sorry. You know, we all like and dislike different things. Hell, I met somebody who doesn't like Tom Baker. You know, I didn't sit there and tell them I'm never talking to them again.
Was it
Lala
Ward?
Oh my Matthew God, Waterhouse. She did say her name was Lala.
Christopher Bidmead. I think, I mean, because there is, I would not be so rude to say that the industry these days sort of offers kickbacks to positive opinions, but I think there is a lot of people who, no, you would say that, I'm going to be neutral, but I would say there's a lot of sites which would want to take advantage of early material or the opportunity of getting early material, who will write a lot of positive things to keep that process going, fearing they might not get it otherwise. And whether they do or they don't, I don't know. I've got no connection to that sort of part of the industry. But it does mean that I think there is a lot more positivity to these things these days. And I do know there are a lot of publicity departments, from talking to people who deal with these sort of things, who do get very funny when you sort of say as a free agent, well, I'm going to say this. And they'll say, well, you know, you're not allowed to. And they're like, why? Or why do you owe me? So, you know, I think these days the internet is something which has this very weird tension between reviewing things or opinion and the fear of how do you get the material to get your opinion at the same time as everyone else. It's a sort of change to press because everything's so instantaneous.
This is one of those things we can blame the technology industry for.
Yes.
And specifically... And I don't wish to name any names, but it is really Apple that are kind of the instigators in this, going back as far as the iPod, really, and then with the iPhone and the iPad, obviously. The whole great positivity about everything, and then, you know, like 3 months later, it turns out there's a massive problem, in some cases 3 days later, like with the antenna gate and that sort of thing. That one is sort of like this Apple uses about this, but you know, these are like recorded things, these things that happen. Like, you've got these great devices that have been hugely praised in the press. People go out and buy them, etc., etc., and then it turns out that they've got a few little niggly problems which the reviewers overlooked or didn't test properly or whatever. So they weren't giving a proper account of the devices or in some ways themselves. And this is spreading to all other industries, including video games. Lego Dimensions, for instance, we tried back when I was running a particular .2 website, despite having a very strong, we had a good route into speaking to the publishers. We also had the fact that we'd done that at Castorbis magazine issue about video games. So we had a strong case for having some previews. I would like to say exclusives, but that's possibly pushing it a bit too much. But having some previews, and we didn't get anything, which is just absolutely absurd, given that I already work as a technology journalist. So, you know, those three things, it just didn't make any sense to me at all that we got absolutely nothing. Yeah, and the BBC is another thing. James might not want to say, but I'm quite happy to say that we've had loads of problems. One of the reasons that I decided to part ways with Castorbis was over the issue of previews, for instance. You know, BBC Worldwide are happy to throw DVD previews at me, but there was absolutely no way to get preview videos of Doctor Who episodes out of BBC itself without licking some arses and also reviewing stuff that I might not necessarily want to review, or that readers of Castorbis might not necessarily be particularly interested in reading about. So that's pretty much how it works.
So what you're saying, and you're saying that they would ask you almost, that there would be a certain expectation on sites, if we give you this, you've also got to do this. Sort of like cinemas used to have block bookings they'd have to take crap. Well, they still do with acquisitions. You know, with various trying to acquire shows, often that comes down to deals of, well, if you want this show, what about if we put this one that we want to offload with you on it as well, and you take both of those? So it happens a lot. And maybe the problem is that because the internet is such, makes everything so immediate and publicity so visible, that there is an even greater desire to be careful who gets the stuff to review. And either way, it does mean it does bring up questions of, when you're listening or you're reading reviews or you're listening to us or whoever, I think you've always got to be questioning intents, choices, mandates. And I'd hope that you'd question ours as much as you'd question anyone else's website and talking to listeners rather than Brian, who I hope
I question you all the time.
Though. Well, maybe you should. But I think it's very true. And I think it's a funny thing to end this podcast on, but I think it's a salient point, is that, yeah, we are talking of our own personal opinions, and I'd like to think that we have no agendas here, and we certainly don't want to see the end of Doctor Who. We certainly don't want anyone to be upset. I don't want, you know, if anyone on the production team listened to this and was, as we've said this before, and was upset by what we said, I feel bad about that.
I think we all do have our own agendas, but they're nothing to do with Doctor Who.
I want to add to what you said there, James, too, and I may have mentioned this before in the past, but it's kind of ironic, having been a reviewer on Castorbis before leaving. I don't know if we're doing the whole not mentioning, but I mentioned it to take it. And doing these kind of reviews on the podcast as well. I find it ironic in the respect that I actually hate reviewers. I dislike the fact that there are reviewers, because too many times have I seen people I know listen to a reviewer about a movie or a TV show, and then they talk about how much they disliked this thing that these people wanted to see. And now after this reviewer, they sit there and they say, hey, you know what? They didn't like it, or my best friend didn't like it, or whatever, and they decide not to go see it. I hope that viewers are more like myself, and I think like you two are, where they will listen to our podcast because they're interested in our opinions, but they'll still afterwards sit there and go, huh, okay, interesting. Let me go see what I think now. Because I never cared whenever a reviewer poo-pooed something that I wanted to see. I still went to go see it because I had that curiosity. I wanted to go see it. If it was bad, well, then guess what? I found out for myself. If it wasn't, then I found out that the reviewer and I had differing opinions, and that's what really makes the world go round. You know, so I would hope that our listeners would sit there and just be curious of our opinion, because in the same respect that you three, excuse me, us three, like to get together. Yeah, my math.
Slowly have broken him.
Yeah. No, but in the way we get together and we like to share our opinions because we like to talk about the show, you know, and we like to talk about it with friends, you know, and it's just, I would hope that people listen to us kind of in that kind of same respect and in some ways, it sounds strange to say it, but in some ways think of us as friends, you know, those opinions that you can get from friends in any way, you know. I just think that's important. Listen to us if you're interested for this, but don't base your viewing the show on what we say. Make up your own.
And as we've said before, you know, our demographic, our expected demographic of this is Doctor Who listeners, Doctor Who watchers, not production team. So if production team are listening to it and they don't like it, you've got to think, well, you're not the demographic. We're not here to sort of either make you feel bad. We're not here to make you feel good. We don't expect you really to be listening. If you are, that's your choice. But our demographic is here. And if you are above the line in the sort of production team and you want to come on and sort of, you know, that's, I suppose, our get out clause, is that if anyone feels that we are misrepresenting what they do and want to sort of come on board and tell us here what you do and why we're wrong, that's cool. I'm happy with that. You know, if I'm wrong, if there's stuff that we say and you want to come onto this podcast and talk to us about it, I think that'd be kind of cool. Not that I think the BBC would let you, but, you know, the point is that we're open to that. We're not, we are trying to say to the listener out here that this is our opinion. If you enjoyed the River Song episode, that's super. That's the best thing. If you got something out of it, that's cool. You've won over me and you've won over Brian and you've won over Christian. We'd have liked to have been in the same position as you. But, you know, it is just our opinions. And hopefully next year will give us something better, or in our opinion, something better, something that chimes with us.
Indeed. And that brings us to the end of this week's podcast with a K, nearly. Podcast with a K. We shall be back in the new year. Enjoy with bits, yeah, and stuff. Until then, enjoy. Goodbye.